Ready?
Sure.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Welcome to the show.
Today on Two Boomer Babes, protecting the elderly from scams and con artists.
Tired of wondering what the heck is for dinner? Quick fix meals for the wannabe chef.
Then a camp where grown-ups go to unplug, get away, and be kids again.
Haven't worn shorts in years? The latest treatment for spider and varicose veins.
And shoot the breeze with the babes. How to choose your next four-legged family member.
The Department of Health and Human Services Administration estimates that 2.1 million older Americans are victims of elder abuse, neglect, or exploitation. And that's only part of the picture. Experts believe that for every case of elder abuse or neglect reported, as many as 5 cases go unreported. Scary statistics.
Craig Treance is an attorney who specializes in protecting the elderly from scams, con artists, and even trusted family members who prey on their elderly relatives and rob them not only of financial resources, but of their dignity as well. He is the co-author of Keeping Your Sister-in-Law Out of Mom's Purse, A Family's Guide to Financial Elder Abuse. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. How are you doing today?
Oh, we're wonderful.
Well, Craig, you have some really scary stories about elder abuse, including one involving a psychic. Tell us what happened with that one.
Basically, this little lady went to this is actually Gil's story. Basically, a little old lady went to a fortune teller who convinced her that the psychic was acting in her best interest, and over a period of time, the psychic hoovered the little old lady to the tune of her entire life savings.
Wow. And
yeah, this is, you know.
It's a scam, real scam.
The fortune-telling scams didn't end with when Miss Cleo got busted. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, so often elder abuse is committed by a family member. So give us an example of one of your cases.
The famous case in the book that we use is a California state senator named Ralph Dills, who was a real power player in California politics in the 40s and the 50s. And he became an Alzheimer's victim. He also was worth a decent amount of money. And in California, state legislators get a fairly outrageous pension, especially if you'd serve for several years. His daughter-in-law, knowing that he was going senile and he was quite the little pot of gold, decided to marry him, took to wearing his late wife's clothing and his late wife's perfume, did marry him, and basically cleaned him out to, again, the tune of several hundred thousand dollars, as well as his pension and stuff like that. And that's a wonderful example of family members being involved.
Craig, how common is it that family members really try to scam their relatives? Is that a common thing?
Depending on whose statistics you want to use, it's somewhere between 40% and 60% of the reported cases.
Wow.
And the second largest group are the professional advisors, attorneys, insurance agents, other financial professionals. And that accounts for the bulk of the claims.
Well, you mentioned the financial advisors, so let's talk about that. Give us an example of financial elder abuse, you know, committed by a so-called financial advisor.
The classic case is the living trust presentation. And, you know, mom and dad will go to a living trust presentation presented by Security First Trust and Federal Reserve Trust Services or something like that. They'll sign up to do a living trust. The key to a living trust is not having the living trust. It's making sure that stuff gets moved into the living trust. That's called funding, and that's where you need to spend your time and effort. Unfortunately, when you go through the funding process, your financial pants are down around your ankles. So the mom and dad, thinking that they're getting a living trust, will go out and make an appointment, and somebody will show up at their house, or they'll come into an office, and they'll fill out the trust questionnaire information and get all their financial account information, and then they're pressured into switching over from their existing retirement accounts or existing bank accounts into usually some type of annuity. And I did, in researching the book, we did talk to a guy that did this before he saw the light. And he was told that he was trained basically to sit at the table with the elder until they either signed the paperwork or called the police. Those were your choices.
Wow. Yeah. So is there any recourse to this? Like, say the son or daughter finds out about this, or even the elder person, you know, realizes that they're being scammed. What's their recourse from these financial advisors?
There's two ways that you can go about doing it. Financial advisors, particularly insurance agents, are all licensed by the various states. And you want to file a complaint with in California, it's called the Department of Insurance. But there will be the equivalent in all of the states, and file a complaint about what happened with the Department of Insurance. A letter from somebody with a state seal at the top of it tends to produce much better results than a letter from one of the kids or even from mom. The other issue is, if you file a complaint with a DOI, you may or may not get a refund, and that's a situation where you may want to consult with a lawyer. And that would be basically a civil case for misrepresentation or breach of contract or breach of fiduciary duty, depending on what was said.
Mm-hmm. But all that takes time and
money.
Resources.
This all takes time. The insurance regulators will work for free. Some attorneys will take these cases on contingency, some won't, and it's going to depend on the facts and circumstances. It also depends on whether or not the insurance agent has what's called E&O coverage. So that's insurance agents. With attorneys, it's a little bit more drastic. You basically, if you suspect an attorney of financial elder abuse, your remedy is to report them immediately to the state bar. Every state bar in the United States takes a very dim view of attorneys stealing from their clients, and the attorney gets shut down pretty quickly.
Besides these groups, the professional groups, what mm-hmm. if we suspect, you know, an elderly loved one is a victim of abuse, but say by a caretaker or another family member? What should we do?
What you're looking for as a family member on the outside is isolation. If mom or grandma or whoever has a caretaker, you want to have access to mom or grandma. You want to be able to call them and speak to them on the phone. You want to be able to take them to lunch. You want to do those things. And classically, when the elder abuse begins, the victim is isolated. You can't get grandma on the phone. You can't drop by and take her over to Denny's for breakfast one morning. It just, she becomes isolated. And at that point, the caretaker begins pounding on the victim until they get added to the bank accounts, they get the beneficiary changes named, and they get the house deeded over to them.
Wow.
So if you're in a situation where your elder has got a caretaker and you can't get through to the elder, you need to call either Adult Protective Services or your local police immediately. This is a police matter, because there may be, in addition to financial elder abuse, there may be physical elder abuse going on.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with elder abuse attorney Craig Treance. Craig, now what if our loved one or the elderly person is in a facility, a care facility, and we suspect that there is neglect, maybe physical neglect or even abuse? What should we do then?
You want to start by taking it to the ombudsman. Most of the facilities will have what's called an ombudsman, who are responsible for basically being the liaison between the patients and the staff. If you don't get satisfaction there, then you want to, again, take it to Adult Protective Services or the regulating agency.
Yeah, because I can see if somebody is in a care facility where they're paying a lot of money, maybe they're, you know, they'll respond a lot quicker. But what happens if somebody's in a Medicaid facility and they have no recourse? They can't move their mother or father.
They have no recourse. And that's where you need the leverage from either the ombudsman's office or a state regulator, because you literally have got nowhere else to go.
Wow. And Craig, can you explain mandated reporter laws? What are they?
Mandated reporter laws are people who, when they see or suspect financial elder abuse, are required to report it or inform law enforcement. And it's bankers, insurance agents, CPAs, that type of thing are mandated reporters. Primarily, it's banks. What is supposed to happen is mom and dad have a bank account at Joe's bank. All of a sudden, mom's got a caretaker. The caretaker's name gets added to the account, and all of a sudden, there's withdrawals for the local casino. That triggers a mandated reporter provision. The bank is supposed to report a suspected activity to the local police who conduct an investigation. When bank employees are trained well, it actually works very well. And there, I have a Google alert on my computer for this type of thing. And probably twice a month, there's a local television news report of some bank in some small town that took the mandated reporting requirement seriously and intercepted what could conceivably be a pretty bad financial a financial theft from an elder.
So, Craig, do you think elder abuse, is it on the increase, or is it just something we didn't think about 25 years ago?
I think it's a combination. It's not something that drew anybody's attention 25 years ago because it was dealt with internally in the family and you didn't have the media saturation that you have now. I also think that post to the Great Recession or Great Depression or whatever you want to call whatever happened since 2008, you're in a situation where the baby boomers, and I'll pick on them, we're cruising along pretty good till 2008, and now there have been some fairly significant financial losses. And it doesn't apply just to baby boomers. It applies to a lot of generations.
Mm. What is the worst elder abuse case you've had to deal with?
This is a case, and I won't name names, where I was hired to write a living trust for an elderly widow who had probably $600,000 or $700,000 in the bank, wrote the living trust, met the new caretaker, no obvious signs or issues of anything going on. She appeared healthy, happy. He seemed to be taking very good care of her. About 3 years later, I get a phone call from the daughter. Hi, I need to talk to you about mom's trust. Okay, what do you know that was in the trust? I said, well, this is the asset list I was given. And she looked at me and says, this is all gone.
Oh.
And he literally cleaned her out to the point that she ended up in a Medicaid facility because she had only her Social Security left.
Wow.
And that's this is the type of case where you turn it over in your mind hundreds of thousands of times looking for what did I miss? What did I miss? What did I miss? And I didn't see it. And I since spoke to the detective that was investigating the case for the local police department who gave me this guy's name. I said, yeah, that's your guy. And he says, well, if it's any consolation, he's now done this to about 10 people. He says, it's not your fault. He's that good.
Wow.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Well, quickly, Craig, we only have a few seconds left, but the bottom line, what's the best way we can proactively protect our loved ones from these scams and abusers?
Stay involved. Pick up the phone. Take mom or grandma or whatever to lunch, especially if it's a long distance relationship. Mom and dad are in New York, for example, and the kids are out here in Las Vegas or wherever it is that they live. Pick up the phone and call, not just on Mother's Day, but every night if possible, certainly four or five times a week. You don't want isolation. Once you get isolation, they become victims. It's an almost certainty.
Craig, are there preventative measures that we can take?
Yeah, ask questions. Mom, how are things going? Good. Any, have you, met anybody new? Well, yeah, I met Susie, and all of a sudden Susie is kind of like living with me and helping me cook. Whoa, who's Susie? Ask questions.
Be involved. Right.
Be involved, and you need to be forward about it. You're dealing with the greatest generation, and the greatest generation does not talk about their problems. They were conditioned not to, and they don't. Okay. Hi. Did you know that you're bleeding all over your leg? Oh, it's nothing really. Pay attention and ask the direct questions. Mom, how are you doing financially? Are you doing okay with your bills?
Craig, what happens if our loved one has dementia or Alzheimer's and they really can't respond appropriately to us? How do we really know? You're saying basically keep on top of everything.
Keep on top. I'll impart to you what I did when my grandmother finally reached that point, and she reached the magic age where she could remember the numbers of her World War II ration tickets, but couldn't tell me if she ate breakfast. And it became a function of you need to step in at that point and take over the affairs. She was lucky because we had done the healthcare planning. We had the healthcare planning of attorney and the financial power of attorney, and everything went smoothly. If you don't have that, you're looking at potentially conservatorship, which is expensive and time consuming. But if you communicate with them often enough, you can track the change. And what you want to look for in talking to them is what I call the changing of the tapes. Okay. As their condition deteriorates, they're going to fixate on 10 or 12 or 15 stories. And when you talk to them and you start hearing the same 10 or 12 or 15 stories, that's when the transmission is slipping, and that's when you need to step in.
Elder abuse attorney Craig Treance, thanks so much for sharing this great advice with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much for having me, and enjoy the rest of your day.
There's nothing quite like being a newlywed. Whether you're a boomer who's found love in midlife or your babette has just walked down the aisle, love is in the air.
But along with that newlywed bliss comes the practical, like what the heck am I going to cook for dinner tonight? Here to help newlyweds navigate the kitchen, stock the pantry, create stress-free quick gourmet meals, or just spruce up old family recipes is Food Network's Robin Miller. Robin is the host of Quick Fix Meals and the author of the Newlywed Cookbook. She joins us from Scottsdale, Arizona, and it's great to have you with us, Robin.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Robin, my daughter's a newlywed and really has kind of that bare bones kitchen, you know, as you can imagine. I know. So tell us, what are the absolute musts, the equipment-wise, that these newlyweds should have in their kitchen?
You know what's interesting? It's when I first wrote the book, this is the third edition. So when I first wrote the book, I was a newlywed. So I got it. I knew what I needed to get through some of the recipes and some of the old standbys like Joy of Cooking and, you know, some, I don't know if you remember the Silver Palette books. Those I was learning how to cook and writing for folks that were in the position that I was in at the time. So that's why I included an equipment index. So that, because at first I was like, a saute pan, skillet, what's the difference? Stock pot, saucepan, what's the difference? So that's why there's an equipment index. And there's also an urban spice index for that reason, too, because I thought, coriander. I wonder what that tastes like and where would I use it?
Well, we're going to ask you about that. But, I mean, in terms of equipment, what about, like, Cuisinars and, you know, well, there's so many gadgets out there.
Well, for the you know, and people are registering things, too. But I swear you can get by with one really good stock pot for things like pasta and big soups and stews, one really good skillet for anything that you want to saute in. I happen to use my food processor, but not every day. It's nice to have, even a little mini prep to help cut down on chopping and dicing and slicing. But a nice cutting board and one really sharp chef's knife. And I feel like you can do every single recipe in my book with just those items.
Oh, I'm going to throw stuff out.
Yeah, really. And you know what? I don't have a few of those items, and I've been married for over 30 years. So what does that say? But, you know, then there's the boomer newlywed who may be combining years of crappy pots and pans like I have and, you know, 30-year-old gadgets and appliances. What should they be pitching and updating, do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what. Some of those, what you call crappy old, I mean, I have a cast iron skillet that has been handed down from my mother's mother to me. That's my favorite pan. It's been seasoned. It's got the flavor. It's adding to it. The same thing, she's got this wonderful colander that's been passed down to me that I love, that they just don't make like that anymore. So I think, you know, if it's a space issue, you find the two or three that you use all the time on each side and save those and donate the rest, you know, instead of just tossing them. There's definitely places that would love to have some good pots and pans. And you really only need a couple of good knives, the knives that feel good in your hand. So if you have two sets of knives, just the ones that fit in your hand and your significant other's hands are really the only ones that you need.
So you don't need all those 20 knives that they try to sell you for $2,000?
Right. And what about those Jinsu knives that last forever?
I have to tell you, I mean, I have several, I have three sets of knives, and I'll tell you why. Just because when I had my show, they would want them to be on your show, right? They would want you using their knife. Calphalon and Viking and everything. And I have like two or three go-tos that I just, I'm doing this, I'm going to use that knife, this, that, and I really, all the rest are just sitting there collecting dust. Because I think you find one that feels good in your hand, and as long as you keep it sharp, you know, it's your best tool.
I think that's the problem with mine. They're not sharp. They won't even cut a tomato.
Yeah, well, that's another segment. I don't even know how to sharpen my knives.
Well, here's the thing, too, is the most dangerous thing in the kitchen is a dull knife, because you press harder and things slip. So you can take them somewhere. It's not expensive. You can take them. I found a guy that was actually, it looked like he was a shoe repair, and also a little sign that he sharpened knives too. Or you can go into a cookware shop. You can go into a Sur La Table, or they have Kitchen Capers on the East Coast. They have, you know what I mean? They have places like that where you drop off your knives and you pick them up a few days later.
Okay, Robin, so let's move on to mealtime, our favorite time of the day. And as we know, newlyweds are busy. You know, they work long hours, or maybe even midlife newlyweds are burned out of cooking. So what's the simplest recipe you have that's just fabulous that you've just put out in your new book?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I know there are a lot of them.
You're asking me to pick a favorite child.
I am.
And one that's easy, easy, easy.
Well, I mean, I got so many. But the one of them I love, and it's, I have a special occasion section in the book, so everything from Super Bowl Sunday to when the in-laws come for dinner and then all the holidays. But I have a, and this is like a special thing, so we don't have to do this one, but the petite lobster tails, because people think lobster is so challenging. But if you're a newlywed and it's a nice way to celebrate, you know, a six-month anniversary, a one-year anniversary, you can buy them frozen super inexpensively, and they're broiled with just a little lemon. And it is a stellar, simple, like three ingredients, an orzo salad on the side. It's just a, you know, rice-shaped pasta tossed with vegetables. I have a glazed ham that makes fabulous leftovers. So you don't really do any of the work. The oven does the work. You buy the ham, mandarin oranges, Dijon mustard, in the oven, and then you have ham sandwiches for the rest of the week.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Robin Miller, host of Food Network's Quick Fix Meals and author of the Newlywed Cookbook. Okay, say if our newlywed kids want to take an old family recipe, which unfortunately I don't have too many, but and they maybe like pot roast, say, or maybe a noodle kugel, and they want to give it an update or a new twist, what do you suggest we do?
There are so many wonderful ingredients that are out there now that internationally inspired ingredients. So you could take the traditional noodle kugel, for example, and fold in dried cherries, top it with slivered toasted almonds. Mm. My friend's grandmother made it with cream cheese and sour cream. And,
right, and lots of
and
butter.
So, and lots of butter. And egg noodles. So I would do the egg-free, and I would use lighter. I never do the fat-free stuff, but just to lighten it up. And then fold in some dried fruit on top of some nuts and just give it, you know, a colorful spin, a little chew, a little sweetness, but also a little, you know, a little savory from the nuts. What was the other one you said, Teresa?
That's a great idea. What about a pot roast or a brisket?
It's so funny. That's what I thought. Yeah, pot roast. Yeah. And I have to tell you, I just made pot roast last week, and I write a blog for Food Network, Healthy Eats. It's called Robin's Healthy Take, and I thought, I don't think pot roast gets it. I think it gets a bad rap because people think it's a fattening. So I did the numbers, and I was like, oh, my gosh. 3 ounces of chuck roast, which is what you would use in a pot roast, like 170 calories. So I was thinking, I think it's what everybody adds to the pot roast or serving it over buttery mashed potatoes. So I took, because I love this time of year, I took apple cider and a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and I just braised the thing for 3 hours at 300 degrees. First, I seared it with thyme and oregano. And this is a spin-off of a recipe in the Newlywed Cookbook. So I always give people inspiration, too, in the head notes in my books. So I seared it, and then I put apple cider, balsamic vinegar, carrots, onions, and some beef broth, good beef broth, 3 hours in the oven, and it fell apart. I served it with two forks. Oh. I pulled it apart with two forks, and I served it over, I fell in love with the spaghetti squash at the store, too. So I just served it over spaghetti squash.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Fabulous. I now have my Friday night dinner.
Yeah. Okay, well, Robin, very quickly, say these newlyweds are about to have their very first dinner party, so besides those lobster tails, and I'm not talking pizza and beer or takeout Chinese, give us a menu.
Okay. I did this on the Today Show from this book. I did a flank steak with a peppercorn melange. Sounds fancy. Your guests are going to say, wow. But all it is searing a beautiful flank steak or a London broil, which will serve six people. And if you're having, you know, if you're having eight, you get two. And you peppercorn melange is sold. It's the green, the white, and the pink peppercorns all sold in the jar. Right. Ooh. Together. So you just grind that up. It looks beautiful. You get a nice crackle of pepper on the outside. You get that a quick sear with caramelized onions. That's an awesome main course. Mm. I have a wonderful spinach salad in there with nuts. And I think this time of year you can add those little pears. And what I also did on the Today Show was this cheesecake, which has a chocolate swirl. So you make my cheesecake recipe, and right before it says you swirl in melted semi-sweet chocolate so it looks like a chef made it or that you bought it at a store pre-made, and it could not be easier.
Well, Robin Miller, host of Food Network's Quick Fix Meals and author of the Newlywed Cookbook, thanks so much for your great tips and for just joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Oh, thank you so much, and congratulations again on your daughter.
Thank you.
And bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Up next, help for the tech addicted. Stay with us. Are you one of those who has your cell phone docked next to the bed, check your email, Facebook, and Twitter several times an hour, and generally spend more time on digital devices than you do interacting with people? If you answered yes, yes, and yes, do we have a camp for you?
Levi Felix is the co-founder of Digital Detox, an organization devoted to teaching those who are tech addicted to disconnect to reconnect. Its latest offering is Camp Grounded, an adults-only summer camp where grown-ups go to unplug, get away, and be kids again. We could use a little of that, Kathy.
We could.
He joins us on the phone from Oakland, California. Welcome, Levi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what's the idea behind Camp Grounded?
The basic idea behind Camp Grounded is that, you know, as adults, as grown-ups, we spend so much of our time, well, obviously working and saving and being grown-ups, but so much of our time in leisure networking and being, you know, being tethered to our devices and always on call. And so the idea about Camp Grounded is to give us the chance to unplug.
Now, we hear that you guys send your campers a very unusual packing list. Can you tell us about it?
The packing list, I mean, there's a lot of do's and don'ts. So, of course, you can't bring your digital devices. And, you know, there's no digital cameras. There's no iPods. There's no iPads. You know, so we start with the things, you know, not to bring. And then the things to bring is you know, journals and books and, you know, musical instruments, you know, and then we also have a lot of events at camp. So we do, you know, last summer we did an 80s prom and, you know, basically, you know, full-on 80s prom. So campers, you know, came out with, you know, ridiculous outfits for the 80s prom. And we have a color wars, which is where the camp is divided into eight teams and everyone competes in absurd and fun games, you know, so they bring, you know, you're assigned to a color and all the campers show up and, you know, with a different color to wear for a day.
Sounds fun. Hey, Levi, I'm sort of fixated on this prom theme. I mean, do people go off and get drunk and hook up, you know, even if they're 50s and 60s?
My God.
So just like camp when we're kids, you know, alcohol is, we don't have alcohol at Camp Grounded. So it's pretty much an alcohol and drug-free event. Because we want people to have the permission to, or opportunity to just let loose without that. And after 3 days of camp, the alcohol isn't even needed. So, yeah, of course, there were some counselors who probably snuck off, you know, before coming to the prom, you know, or maybe they punched or spiked the punch. But for the most part, campers showed up and got loose without the intoxication. And there were some couples that were formed at camp as well. I had one camper come up to me and say, hey, I never had a camp girlfriend. I never went to camp when I was a kid. And, yeah. And now I've been dating this girl for a few weeks. And so that was really special to see, is like, you know, truly reliving what it meant to be a camper.
So is there any sitting around the campfire and, you know, eating s'mores and singing Kumbaya? Does that happen there too?
So we didn't sing Kumbaya. I mean, I didn't sing Kumbaya this year, but there's definitely, you know, there's three campfires going on every night, and we have musicians that we bring in, and we have a song leader, Celtie's his name. So there's multiple song sessions, and I was at one campfire where there was four guitars, two banjos, I think one or two mandolins, someone on violin, and probably about 20 people singing harmony, probably about 50 people around that fire in general. And so there's tons of campfires and sing-alongs. We have an all-campfire sing-along on Friday night where, you know, all 300 people show up and we sing, and it gets really goofy. And we at night we bring out s'mores. We have vegan s'mores this year for the vegan, and I think we even had gluten-free crackers. So we had vegan and gluten-free crackers for some of the campers, and hot chocolate. And at night we encourage people to quote unquote sneak out. So, you know, we tell everyone to go to bed and then we wink at them. And, you know, at night there's a tea lounge, there's, you know, live music stage. There was a puppeteer who was walking around the woods. So it's kind of like when you were a kid, you were told to go to bed, but you always wondered what happened in the woods at night.
Well, what are the accommodations like? I mean, do we get plush bathrobes and hair dryers?
At Camp Grounded, you don't get plush bathrobes and hair dryers. However, there are a few options. There's like these open-faced Adirondack cabins. So there's 9 villages, and each village has a few different cabins. And so campers stay in cabins or bunk beds. So they're pretty rustic, similar to what you'd see. You know, it's an old Boy Scouts camp. It's a refurbished 1970s Boy Scouts camp called Camp Navarro. It's beautiful. And so we have these bunk bed communal cabins, and then we also offer what we call BYOT, so bring your own tent. So I'd say about a quarter of the campers bring their own tent, and they, you know, camp in a tenting village where they set it up themselves. And this year, I think we're going to be offering another option for those who don't want to bring their own tent and those who are traveling from the East Coast or from out of state. And actually, we have over 16 states represented at camp, and I think over 3 countries, 4 countries last year, and this year more. So we're going to be offering a package where we'll have a tent and some sleeping bags and some stuff for you when you arrive, if you'd like.
I want to ask you real quickly, are you on a cell phone?
I am on a cell phone.
Aha. Uh-huh. So do you practice what you preach? Do you detox digitally?
Yes. We're not against digital devices, right? Technology is not a bad thing, and we're using it to have this conversation. It's just all about balance. So I have a cell phone. I have a computer. You know, I have my gadgets. You know, I come from a pretty geeky background.
But everything in moderation, right?
Yeah, well, it's not even moderation. It's just, I think mindfulness and awareness and balance. You know, so it's, when we go to pull out our phone, it's, why are we pulling out our phone to take a picture of everything? You know, why are we waiting for the doctor in the doctor's office or at the restaurant for our friends to show up, and we pull out our phone and start fiddling with it? You know, it's that moment we could say, no, I can just sit here and be by myself again. Because in the moment when you're just being, you know, that's what being human is all about. So I think it's becoming aware of our cell phone and our computer and our screen use. And if we look and say, man, I'm spending, you know, 5, 7, 8, the average American spends 8 to 12 hours a day on their computer, so or on a screen. So I think if we're spending more of our waking life on a screen than not, then it's just a matter of saying, okay, where can I fill that time with more human interaction or more of me time where I'm not just consuming other people's media? So,
do you have a sense of how effective the camp experience is for unplugging long term? I mean, do these campers go right back to their evil ways once they hit the real world?
So I've gotten a lot of feedback from campers. I was speaking to one earlier this week, and you know, she's a lawyer, and she went back to her real world, quote unquote real world, and she made some changes. You know, no more cell phones in the bedroom. She no longer has a cell phone or TV or computer when she eats. And she makes small changes, and a lot of our campers make small changes that affect their life at large. And so I think what we're trying to do is help introduce concepts to people and also let them get away and rethink about their life, and also, you know, let's just have fun at Camp Grounded and digital detox. But yeah, there is long-term effects in giving people the opportunity to make small changes. And so, you know, I think across the board, majority of our campers, when they return home, do change something. And often it starts in the bedroom, and it starts in the bathroom, and it starts around the dinner table, saying, okay, we're not going to have a cell phone or a screen in those spaces. And starting there will change everything.
Well, Levi Felix, co-founder of Digital Detox and Camp Grounded, which sounds like a whole lot of fun, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks so much for having me.
We Babes really love receiving your feedback. 2 listeners contacted us to suggest that we do a segment about vein restoration. They both had unsightly veins, which just seemed to get worse with each passing year. Surprisingly, these 2 women both sought the help of Dr. Rory Byrne, a surgeon with more than 30 years' experience as a vein specialist.
Our listeners' very words, "We're no longer embarrassed to wear shorts," got us thinking. This would be a terrific topic for a show. After all, there are more than 30 million Americans suffering from vein issues, including the 2 Boomer Babes. We reached out, and guess what? Dr. Rory Byrne is sitting right here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome, Dr. Byrne.
Well, thank you very much for having me, ladies.
So what exactly is vein restoration?
Well, to start out with, it's a misnomer. It's a misnomer because we're not actually restoring the vein. We are removing the damaged vein. And the damaged vein might simply be unsightly, as in spider veins, but it might cause symptoms, as in varicose veins.
Now, I remember many years ago, my mom actually had her veins stripped, and the words alone just sound totally barbaric. Have vein procedures hopefully changed a lot since those days for both varicose and spider veins?
Well, it's funny that you use the word barbaric, because that's the way I always regarded the actual stripping of the vein. I won't describe it, but it is barbaric, and I, as an intern, actually assisted in doing it, so I have firsthand knowledge. The treatment of varicose veins has come an awfully long way from the point of view of the stripping. The treatment for the spider veins, remarkably, has changed very, very little, but it's still a phenomenal treatment.
Well, why is it that as we age, it seems like these veins appear more and more? I mean, is that just part of the process, or is it due to, do we inherit this? I mean, where do they come from?
Or maybe weight?
Or pregnancy?
Well, the single most important contributing factor, unquestionably, is heredity. And even though your mother may not have had them or your father may not have had them, he or she may have had the genetic predisposition to it, which they passed on to you. Other factors do intercede. Weight does have an effect, but not as great as most people think or fear. Females are much more likely to fall prey to the ravages of vascular disease in the vein side. The female hormones have a direct and many indirect effects on the veins themselves. The direct effects would be to reduce the elasticity of the vein. The indirect effects would be to allow the woman to menstruate regularly. When the woman menstruates regularly, there are profound deleterious effects on the veins. And if she decides to become pregnant, well, that's even worse. And the only thing worse than the pregnancy itself is the labor. There are fantastic pressures on the veins. The veins have to travel uphill against gravity from the toes to the heart. And, of course, what happens in pregnancy is you have an increased blood volume to accommodate the growth in your tummy. You have diminished elasticity in the veins. So although you have an increased blood flow, you have worse elastic recoil. Then you've got this gorgeous little baby sitting right smack on top of the access route from the legs through the pelvis into the abdomen and up to the heart. And if you think that you've got that plug sitting over your veins, it's like you parking on the garden hose and can't figure out why the flow's not so good.
Ooh, sounds man. Like we earned those veins, though. And, Doctor, how does menopause factor into this whole thing?
Well, funnily enough, with menopause, the female hormones diminish. They become irregular in their output initially and eventually fall off to very low levels. So, ironically, although it's the latter stages of the ages of the veins, the ongoing damage diminishes. So while we see people presenting to us in the menopausal age, the damage has come from their earlier years, particularly the childbearing years.
Okay.
Wow. So they just start to appear more so as we age.
Yeah. It's a gradual thing. I see young girls coming into me today, 15, 16, 17 years old, who have spider veins. And I suspect it's the birth control pill. It's the artificial substitution of high levels of female hormones. But it's also a wear and tear thing. There's not a lot of wear and tear that's happened in a 15-year-old, but by the time you get to be 60, 70, 80, there's been an awful lot of wear and tear. And those veins have carried a lot of blood. They've suffered a lot of trauma, a lot of insults. And although they've soldiered on very, very nicely, they do break down.
Okay, so say we do have a genetic predisposition to varicose or spider veins. Is there something that we can do to alleviate before we have to go see somebody like you?
Yeah, these unsightly devils that appear.
I'm the unsightly devil?
No, you're not an unsightly devil.
You're very sightly, actually.
You're very good looking.
I've got my radio face on today.
We're talking about our veins.
Eye candy, listeners.
Well, the one thing that you brought out was heredity, and of course that we cannot change. But as far as prevention goes, there are things that can be done. The factors that we can influence are things such as heat, tightness of the clothing, and posture. When I speak of heat, I'm talking about
sitting up very straight.
Yeah, she's got her nun's look on. When I speak of heat, it's the exposure to heat through hot tubs, hot baths, hot saunas, hot showers. And if you're the sort of person who goes home and has the hot bath once every several days, that's not so bad. But I have patients who go home after a very stressful day here in D.C. They go home, they jump in the tub, they grab a novel, and they keep cranking out the hot, hot, hot water to alleviate the stress. Unfortunately, that's also very stressful for the veins. By the same token, living in the D.C. area or anywhere where you're exposed to excessive heat through the ambient temperature outside, that too will take its toll. And it's not so much the light of the sun, but the heat of the sun. So even if it's midnight, if it's 95 degrees and you're sitting out on your deck, it's not going to help. Hot showers, if you're proposing to have a hot shower, perhaps make it not as hot, not as long. Saunas are the same sort of idea, not as frequently, not as hot, not as long. Now, as far as tightness of clothing goes, the younger girls of today are all wearing the skinny jeans. And the skinny jeans are great when they're standing, but as soon as they sit, they bend at the knee, they bend at the hip, and they cut off the circulation. Women more my age would wear perhaps some knee-high stockings. The knee-high stockings, if you look at your legs once you take them off, have left a very nice indent in the area just below the knee. So, of course, that's cutting off the superficial circulation, which accelerates the formation of the spider veins.
Ah, well, there are just a lot of things that I do that I shouldn't be doing. Check, check, check on all those hot tubs and hot showers. Now, we've talked about these veins occurring in women. What about men? Do men also suffer from varicose veins?
The incidence of varicose veins in men is significantly lower than in women because of the female hormones. Men do produce female hormones, but in very diminished levels. So that major contributing factor is gone. The real troublemaker, of course, is now heredity. And almost every male that comes to us has some sort of family background he is aware of. As far as spider veins go, well, men do get spider veins, but men are big chickens. We've got hairy legs, we wear long pants, and we'd have to be dragged kicking and screaming to the doctor to get anything treated. That's the way of the men.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Rory Byrne, a surgeon who specializes in the treatment of spider veins. So, Dr. Byrne, say we're come to your office and we want to, you know, you're going to do a procedure on us for these veins. What's involved?
Well, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you're both coming into my office and you're both going to subject yourself to the wonderful treatment.
And
the bad news is you're both coming in to get the treatment.
Oh, gosh.
Well, when you do come, we treat all patients equally, of course. The idea is when you come in and you get past the front desk when they take all the demographic information, you come to me. I try, first off, to put the patient at ease because even the patients who aren't nervous are nervous. It's just the way it is. They don't know what to expect for the most part. They've had all these stories told to them over the years, which are mostly fictitious. So I sit down and we speak, we chat, and then we just do a very rough and cursory medical history. See if there is a history of varicose veins or spider veins. See if there's symptoms attached to the veins. Do they have pain, heaviness, aching, discomfort, itching, swelling? And from there, I examine the veins. It's primarily a visual examination. And we map them out. And I sit down with the patient and I discuss thoroughly what the options are. And interestingly, 90% of the patients that come to me will start right then and there. The biggest deterrent, of course, is anxiety. And I always say to my patients that it hurts, but it hurts very little. And one of the comments I have heard most often over the years is, wow, had I known that's all it was, I would have been here years ago.
Well, I hope it doesn't involve needles or blood or anything like that, because I faint.
Oh, no, I have a magic wand. And it's I use a needle, yes.
Oh.
And I've never fainted.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you.
Well, that's fortunate. <You're> not...
The needle is tiny. It's smaller than any needle that was ever used to vaccinate your babies. So
like
the
an acupuncture type needle?
Oh, yep. It's as small as that.
Oh. And is this procedure, so spider vein procedures, are they covered by insurance?
Spider veins are rarely covered by insurance because they're primarily cosmetic in origin. Now, my colleagues with whom I work, they actually do primarily the varicose types of veins. And yes, the varicose veins are almost exclusively covered by insurance, for the main reason being, of course, that they are not cosmetic, but in fact a medical condition.
And real quickly, what happens during that procedure? How do you get rid of the varicose veins?
Well, the varicose vein, first of all, entails a mapping through use of ultrasound, a very high-classy type of technique, whereby they examine the roots of the veins. They look for the backward flow, which is the key. Okay, the blood's supposed to flow one direction. When you get backward flow, that's the key. These will be mapped out by our certified ultrasonographers, and then you will meet with the surgeon who will, in fact, review the ultrasound with you, go through the whole procedure and the various options. And there's no such thing where we come from called stripping. We have several techniques. We have the closure technique, we have foam sclerotherapy, and we have phlebectomies. The closure technique is what has replaced the stripping, and it's a very high-tech, very fancy and very clever procedure whereby a tiny little nick is made to gain entry into the vein, and a very small probe is pushed the whole way up through the vein while being visualized on ultrasound. It's done in the office, and I walk by those rooms, and I hear the patients chatting away. So don't worry, Kathy.
So they're
it's
awake?
No big
oh,
deal.
Good.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh,
it's,
my gosh.
It's so benign.
Dr. Rory Byrne, surgeon and vein specialist who practices in the Washington, D.C. area, thank you so much for sharing this terrific info, and we just can't wait to make an appointment.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in my offices.
We can't wait. Barb, I don't know about you, but I can't walk into an animal shelter and come out empty-handed.
You know, that's why I don't even go near those places. But for those who can't resist, we've called a pro who can help us find and adopt just the right family pet. Animal advocate Marion Zola co-produced the PBS show Shelter Me, a program about shelter dogs, and she's the author of Romancing the Dog, The Struggle to Make a Pound Dog Happy in Beverly Hills. She joins us from California to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome, Marion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marion, you know, pets can really transform our lives. I cannot imagine my life without all of my little pound puppies that I have. But when we go to a shelter looking to adopt our next family member, what besides adorable should we be looking for?
Well, first of all, you have to know what kind of family you have. If you have a family with small children, or if you have just two adults, it's a different thing. Two adults alone, you have different requirements than you do with dogs with small children. Fortunately, the shelter employees usually know their dogs pretty well, and they will do an assessment before putting the dog up for adoption. So they know which dogs would fit well with which people who come in to adopt. They have trainers who assess them, and they're very honest about the personality and pluses and minuses of all the dogs, because they don't want the poor animal to come back or to not have a successful adoption.
Right. Well, Marion, say they tell you that this dog has an issue, like maybe he bit the UPS man. He didn't kill him, but he might have maimed him slightly. Should we always stay away? I mean, it's once a bad dog, always a bad dog?
Absolutely not. You don't know the circumstances of that, and I would, again, have an evaluation by a trainer. You don't know if somebody grabbed the dog in a wrong way or caused him pain, but believe me, the documentation on dog bites or dog aggressiveness is so stringent in this country. I wish people were assessed half as much.
Yeah.
The poor animals, any little negative incident is completely recorded, and if there's a second incident, there are tremendous consequences. Even with a first incident, they're usually confined to the house for 10 days, and they do an evaluation. It's very, very difficult. And being in contact with so many people who adopt, I can tell you that most adoptions are very successful.
That's great. So we can reform our dogs.
Absolutely.
Good. So tell us, what are the top three things we should be doing daily with our pets?
Okay. Well, one of the things to do is brush them. That'll cut down a lot on the shedding. That makes a big difference. Even if it's just a few minutes, play with him. Give him undivided attention. Because a lot of people just walk by their pets as if they're pieces of furniture and never really focus on the dog. And the dog is waiting, and the cat is waiting all day to get your exclusive attention. Play with him, even if it's just for a few minutes. And talk to the dog. and even the cat. If they don't understand the specific words, they do get the tone.
Marion, one more question. If we are in the shelter and we see an adorable dog, is there some breed that if we know, if for example, a pit bull, if they're part pit bull, are there any breeds that we should just stay away from?
Well, I can't tell you how many people I know with pit bulls that are the sweetest, most affectionate dogs you ever met. In England, they were known as the nanny dogs. They used to guard the children. Pit bull is a slang expression. They've gotten a terrible rap because of how they've been abused in this country with the dog fighting, and there are a lot of, there have been a lot of incidents, but look what they've done to these animals. A lot of breeds, you know, have a bad reputation, but they're really not bad breeds. There's really no bad breed. If I had small children, I'd stay away from tiny dogs, because tiny dogs really can't defend themselves against the kind of tail pulling and ear pulling and fur pulling that a lot of kids do. And they will nip because they need to protect themselves.
Well, Marion Zola, animal advocate and author of Romancing the Dog, The Struggle to Make a Pound Dog Happy in Beverly Hills, thanks so much for great advice and for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and have a great day, and love your animals.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.